Jason Jace Bell is not just a Yorkshireman, not just a stalwart of the Kafka community, but he's also a guy who actually operates Kafka clusters on behalf of customers for a living. So he has to know how it's done. We talk about how he got into this role, what the challenges of Kafka DevOps are, and what he wishes all Kafka developers knew on this episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I continue to be your host, Tim Berglund. I have not changed my name. And I am, as usual, excited to be joined in the virtual studio by a new guest. Today it is Jason Jace Bell, Kafka DevOps engineer at consulting firm Digitalis. Jace, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I am very glad to have you on. I want to talk about, I mean, really your job. That's kind of the thing.
Okay.
But tell us the story. How do you get to be a Kafka DevOps engineer? Just what's your, give us your career story. How'd you get to where you are?
Okay. Well, my career is 32 years and we've only got 45 minutes. So,
summarize.
I'll condense it down a bit. I started off as a hardware engineer back in 1988 when I was 16. And during the course, it turned out that everyone wanted to be a software developer instead. So I learned C at that stage. And then over a period of time, I've been involved in software development, supply chain, customer loyalty. Did a lot of data mining in the early 2000s. So things like the Target Baby story and the way that the Tesco club card works, which is a loyalty card in the UK for anyone not in the UK. How those kinds of data mining things work fascinate me, and they still do.
The Target Baby story being the young woman who started receiving maternity promotions at home.
Yes, she was.
Before her family knew.
Her father found out, yeah. Her father was less than amused and went to the store and complained of why his daughter was getting these baby club offers. And then he went back about 2 or 3 weeks later, apologizing because he'd been given some new information.
Right. It was in fact the game that he should have been hating and not the player in this case.
Yeah. So those kinds of things fascinate me. And around sort of 2009, 2010, I started getting into the big data side of things. So I was doing a lot of Hadoop work. And then that led me into more streaming things when Spark came out. So the Spark streaming API and those kinds of things, which then eventually led me to RabbitMQ. And I made a confession in the Cleveland meetup last night that the reason that I used RabbitMQ is because I didn't like having a zookeeper dependency on Kafka. But I'm sure we'll talk about that later. and then I moved on to Kafka. I moved on to Kafka about 2014, and I worked with a company called Mastodon C in London, and I looked after a couple of Kafka clusters for them, and that's how I really got into it. I came in fairly, I knew bits and pieces about streaming data, those kinds of things, but in terms of actually looking after a Kafka cluster, I've never really done that before. You know how it is, Tim. People kind of fall into these things by learning while doing. It's like, we need to look after this. Here you are. And then you just go off and start learning about it and how it all works. So that cluster was really interesting. So it was for flight search data. That's as much as I can say about it. So it was an awful lot of data that's being passed through. So it was really interesting because we ended up having to rebuild that cluster, and we started using Marathon and Mesos for deployment, which comes with its own set of problems. So I was there for 3.5 years, and then I moved to Digitalis last June, and I've been looking after Kafka clusters for them since. I absolutely love working with this tech. So it's kind of what I'm known for now. is working with Kafka and Hadoop, mainly Kafka, not so much Hadoop now, but yeah, it's kind of what I'm known for.
Yeah, which is not a bad thing to be known for. Interesting, the early part of your story, you and I have some overlap. I had aspired to be a hardware designer. That's kind of really where I think I was headed, where I was trying to head, and ended up getting a firmware job as a sophomore in college. It wasn't like a formal internship program. It was just a startup in 1992 looking for cheap labor. And they found some, and there I was, and I learned this craft.
Cheap labor. It's great, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. Well, it's not like I didn't benefit from that arrangement.
Absolutely. We used to do a lot of stuff on single board computers, and you were basically flipping switches and pressing a button to commit the binary number.
And right.
Then after 10 minutes, yeah, you hoped that the LEDs did actually flash at the end, because if they didn't, you'd done it wrong.
Right.
So yeah, it was interesting. It was great fun. And you look back now, and it's interesting how things have come full circle, because we've now got Arduino units and we've got the Raspberry Pi and those kinds of things, and they're absolutely fantastic to learn on. So I think there's some good Kafka posts on running Raspberry Pi clusters on Kubernetes and that kind of thing, which I've not really had time to look at, but it's something I want to get into. All good fun.
Yeah, there was a Kickstarter, some outfit doing a little 8-module Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I saw a pre-order for it, and I can't remember what it was called. I was looking for it the other day.
Yeah, if I find it, we'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, great.
But I mean, I looked at it. It was one of those aspirational Kickstarters that, like, and I want to be the kind of person who does this, so yeah, I'll pay for this thing. And but I knew, like, I'm not going to make time for that. So I didn't do it, but.
Oh, tell me about it. I mean, you know, between Moleskin notebooks and bits of Arduino hardware and Raspberry Pi hardware, it's like, I'll do something with that and then never do. I've got SIM card readers and barcode readers from previous customer loyalty startups that I've been working on. There's all sorts of kind of stuff kicking around the house that never gets
you. For a while for me, it was FPGA Kickstarter projects. Do FPGA development on this easy board. Like, yeah, I want to do that. You know, I stopped after like three of them. Like, okay, I'm actually probably not going to make time for this. I understand that I aspire to be that person, but I'm just not. So that's okay.
Yeah, I think the last Kickstarter thing I contributed to was there was a chap that was making potato salad.
That's right. It was just that, right? It was just, yeah, I'm going to make
it. It was just potato salad. I want feedback on potato salad that I made. And it's like, well, I didn't receive any, but I do want to support you. So it was great. Right. It was the greatest potato salad.
No, I remember seeing that. I didn't support it because I hate potato salad. So it just didn't make any sense. But
I'm not a huge fan, in all fairness, but you know, it was just the audacity of doing a Kickstarter for potato salad. I absolutely love stupid stuff like that.
Right. It was more the aesthetic of it than the actual.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Experience of putting potato salad in your mouth. And
I wasn't actually interested in eating the end product. Right. No. It was just like, if you want $5 to make a potato salad, then
I'm going to get tweets about this. By the way, I know I'm going to get tweets about my hatred of potato salad, and I
know Twitter has its moments, but that's a bit strong, Tim.
I think I will. I think we'll find out. Well, I do. In fact, I'm gonna call him out. I think Neil Buesing is gonna tweet about this.
Oh, so, no! Neil, come on, no, Neil. Neil won't do that, because
yes,
Neil,
he will.
He will listen to me before he'll listen to you.
Accept the challenge, Neil.
It was good to see Neil last night in the Cleveland meetup, actually.
Yes, good, excellent, solid guy. Anytime I can spend time with that guy is a good thing.
The one nice thing about the community on the Confluent community side of things, with the meetups, especially this year with COVID and everything, is everyone's so supportive. And I've met a bunch of people now that I wouldn't have got to have met otherwise, with the exception of Twitter. So it's been really good this year, because I've met Dave Klein, and I've met Shay, Anna McDonald, Mitch Henderson, and, you know, Neil, and a bunch of other folks. It's been brilliant this year. for that?
Yes. Dave Klein, who at the time of this recording, this is not announced and not a thing, but by the time this airs, Dave Klein will be a developer advocate here at Confluent. That's a happy thing.
Brilliant. Very glad to have news.
Yes.
Brilliant. Oh, that's great news.
Yes. It'll be old news on Twitter by the time this airs, but I just wanted to say the words.
So how much do I have to bribe him to be one of the Confluent community champions then?
Yes. Well, that's all back channel. We can't talk about that on the air.
All right. Okay. Oh, we can have a conversation later.
A clear nominee for the 2021 class.
You're very kind. I'm not too sure of that, to be honest, but anyway.
Well, 2014 makes you a fairly early adopter for Kafka.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. It was not what it is now then. I was certainly aware of it.
No. And that was something I was talking about last night, oddly enough. I was talking about, this is really sad. These are the things that keep me going. I was talking about the performance test tools for the producer and the consumer in the command line and how they were great for performance testing on producer to broker to consumer. But with all the tools that we now have, whether that's KSQL, Kafka Connect, schema registry and other bits and pieces like that, doing end-to-end testing with those tools is actually really difficult.
Okay. Well, talk to me about the about what you've tried to do and how it's been hard.
when
give
I'm
me an example.
When I'm testing Kafka Connect, what I actually do is just look at the logs and panic.
that is very normal.
It's just like, help! Seriously. Monitoring wise, we tend to use Prometheus for monitoring. So I have access to pretty much every metric that's coming out. We'll do an awful lot of functional testing. And the nice thing, even though I do DevOps, I'm still a developer at heart as well, you know?
Right.
So it doesn't stop me writing a basic consumer or producer with an Avro payload, for example, and testing it that way. So some of the clients that we have, I'm not necessarily involved in any of the development, so I don't know what dev teams are doing. I'm merely responsible for the cluster itself. So anything that goes in from a consumer, anything that goes in from a producer, and goes out to a consumer is none of my business, because those messages are essentially private information. Which is
Got
good.
It.
I don't need to
Got
know. It. I don't need to know. I don't want to know. And I've signed NDAs to say that I won't look. So I won't. So when it comes to testing like that, it tends to be a team sport. But the interesting thing is especially over the last couple of weeks when I said I'd do this talk on capacity planning, really went down into the internals of disk and network throughput into a level that I've not really considered before. So it was an actually really interesting learning exercise. Testing's been interesting, in all honesty. And I think it's something I'm still learning as I go. Some things are working, some things aren't. A lot of it I do in my own time as well, you know, because I'm still a serial tinkerer of Kafka outside of work hours to see how these things work and how we can improve things. I've never committed anything though, which is a bit of a shame. I will do one day, I'm sure.
It's okay. There are other ways to be a part of the community. You can
I can bore everyone to tears. I think that's becoming
been my strategy for some years now. And it seems to be working out. So.
If it's working for you, I'm sure it'll work for me as well.
Yeah.
So we went down this interesting rabbit hole yesterday. What I was really getting at is the days of saying, can you create me a topic, are kind of gone, because it's now create a topic. Oh, I'm using Kafka Connect. Okay. Have you got DLQs? And then DLQs are more topics which have got more partitions and replication factors. So therefore there's an impact there. I've got 5K SQL jobs as well. Oh, right. Okay. So that's another 4 times 5, you know, partitions plus replication, and it starts
and the internal
out.
Topics associated with those queries,
absolutely, and then obviously things like aggregations have network capacity considerations to take into account if you're taking huge volumes of data through to do aggregated counts and those kinds of things. So, yeah, it's actually been really interesting. But like you say, 2014, the streaming API didn't exist then. And I caught the first wave of the streaming API, which was really interesting for me because I was writing consumers to save data onto things like Amazon S3 because Kafka Connect didn't exist at that time. Oh. And then the streaming API came out, and actually I started writing streaming API jobs to do those kinds of data dumps onto S3. And it was, when did I first really see the power of streaming API? I'll tell you what it was. It was at Strata London. I think it's 2015 in the end. And Michael Knoll was doing an intro talk to the streaming API. And then the year after he did KSQL, and it was like, right. Michael, you've just written off 80% of my streaming API jobs with that. So, yeah, Michael's really good. I like Michael.
Very much.
It's an interesting ecosystem, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have actually spent most of this year just trying to keep up.
It's my job.
It's your job, yeah. You get paid for that. Yeah.
To keep up, and it is a lot of work.
I get paid for that too.
You do, don't you? Right. Yeah. Great things about your being a Kafka DevOps and me, you know, just for one thing, doing this podcast, I get to keep up with all kinds of things. It's good.
Yeah. Why are you talking to me?
Why am I talking to you?
Yeah.
Actually, Jason, I'm asking the questions here. This is my interview, but no, you're.
I'm sorry.
I don't have to answer that.
I told you this wouldn't be serious. I warned you in advance.
You 100% warned me, and here we are, and it's delightful. So
you're regretting it? No, because you've got half an hour to go yet.
You're got. That's true. That's true. No, I mean you're a guy who runs Kafka in production. So yeah, we were talking about the command line data gen tools.
Yeah, that goes with my age. The command line is my place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's so very, it's funny. Okay. So talk about age. We'll talk about my adult son who was asking me a tech question. He normally does web development and game development on a Mac, and he was having to do something on Windows. And he's like, why is there no homebrew on Windows? I can't install Git. Like I'm having a trouble installing Git on the command line. Do people just use the GUI? Yeah, they use the GUI. It's okay. You know, you're still a good developer. It's just how it works on Windows. And there are good reasons for that. But apparently I've passed on that love of the command line to the next generation, which is good. Which is good.
Cool. Yeah. What is, he has a very valid point though. No homebrew on Windows.
There's no homebrew on Windows. There's no package manager on Windows. And I think the thing, and Windows developers, I encourage you to tweet correction at me here or just more information. But I know the command line experience has gotten better recently. It's just that for literally decades, it was kind of a children's toy, you know, over in the olden days, Unix world and later in Linux, we had these sophisticated programming environments that we called a terminal. And you know, command prompt wasn't that. And so the tools ecosystem that evolved given that constraint was, yeah, a lot of GUI things because that's how you got work done there.
And
that's not the case anymore, but it's still sort of that tradition carries over.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely. I remember the old Solaris boxes. They were great.
Yes. That was actually my first job. That firmware job, there was a network management system being developed on Solaris, and I wrote some, what did they call it? It was a Sun API that just wrapped the socket API, TLI maybe.
Right.
And it was, everything was just like a direct analog to the socket API. And I was like, why are we doing this? But that was my first Unix code. Anyway, Kafka DevOps, what kinds of things come up in your daily? You're operating on-prem clusters or clusters on self-managed cloud instances. What's hard about that?
On-prem, all on-prem.
All on-prem. Okay.
Yeah. I'm a bare metal freak.
Nice. Sheet metal, data centers, blinky lights. Cold
air. I don't see them. I assume that other people do.
Somebody does.
I work from home. I have worked from home for 9 years, so COVID doesn't really affect me.
Right.
And I feel for anyone that it has affected. Seriously.
Right.
Because a few friends of mine are going, I don't know how you do this. And it's like, well, quite easy, actually.
Doing it for a while.
As long as I know where the kettle is and I can make a cup of tea, then all is good with the world.
Everything is fine.
Exactly. So, the on-prem stuff, they're medium-sized clusters that I work with. I can't go into numbers, or I'd be uncomfortable with going into numbers. But they're fairly hefty throughputs. The usual monitoring stuff. We have alerts coming out of our ears if we need to, for in-sync replicas going down, repartition jobs that are taking too long, all sorts of stuff. But on the day-to-day basis, like I said previously, because I don't get involved with the coding of the applications, it's up to those teams to tell me what they want. So they, in test environments, they kind of have run of the show, so they can do whatever they wish. If they need to create a topic, they'll create a topic. Usually when they run their application for the first time and it automatically creates a topic. And then I get a little bit upset because I just see all these topics that have only got one partition and one replica. but you know what? It's not their fault, so it's fine. And then schema registry through the REST API, those kinds of things. But when you start getting onto pre-production and production things, then it becomes requests and justifications for why they need those certain things. And then it's up to me to create those topics, apply those ACLs, and sort the schema registry out for them. Those kinds of operations. Install a Kafka Connect connectors. Me and Kafka Connect have become quite good friends over the last 12 months. So that's kind of the day-to-day. And what I've also done and made a very conscious effort for in the last sort of 6 months is with our clients being very involved with their internal development communities as well. So I might do a presentation or two about the ecosystem or about the Streamy API in KSQL because developers have questions and they don't necessarily know how Kafka works, but they're developing applications for it. You see what I mean?
That is a chilling statement, but it's true. Yeah. They're just doing their job. They're trying to understand the domain and everything else about their platform and frameworks and everything. And here's this new data infrastructure that is a little weird, and shouldn't it just be why can't it just have the courtesy of being a database?
Yeah, and it's actually really interesting because when you surround yourself in an ecosystem like Kafka, with a very tight community like the Confluent Kafka community is, and the wider Apache Kafka community, don't get me wrong, the assumption is we all know how it works, partitions, replication factor, consumer groups, all those kinds of things. And it was impressed on me this year, especially when talking to the developer communities within some of our clients, who I'm not meaning this in a horrible way, who just don't understand the sort of core concepts because they don't need to. In reality, it's like, oh well, we need you to write a producer that sends this message and bundles it as an Avro and sends it to the producer, and as long as they've got their broker addresses and ports correct in their properties, after that it doesn't really matter. Now I have made it my mission this year to get people to be more serious about things like retries, because one of the sort of questions I get is, oh, I sent a message and I got an exception back because it didn't send. And it's like, okay, you start looking into it. And then I go start looking through the logs. And yeah, I'm quite good at reading Kafka server logs now. And I can usually correlate a rebalance somewhere just at the time that they were sending that message. There you go. Okay, so we then have to start talking about retry policies and those kinds of things. And what is your axe set to? Is it all zero or one? You know, oh, well, it's set to zero. I said, well, that's fire and forget.
Yes.
You know, and so what happens to your message could be anyone's guess. So then I then start providing, like, the producer interceptor classes, so and little sort of wrap demos of those to say, okay, so when your message sends, then there's this listener that will say, oh, here you go. The message was sent, okay. And then, yeah, it's all those kinds of little educating things, which makes everybody's life easier. It also helps increase the adoption going forward as well, which is actually really important, because you'll always come against push and pull. And, you know, I've heard so many times people say, oh, but Kafka isn't that performant. And it's like, I beg your pardon. Where did you hear that from? You know, and then, oh, I heard from so, and it becomes this whole whisper circle of I heard it from so-and-so at the water cooler, who heard it from someone else at the coffee machine, who heard it on the radio somewhere. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And I'm fairly sure this happens in a lot of places. I don't think it's just me and any, you know, in isolation. But I always felt that my job was to encourage and educate those kinds of things. So, I mean, I've sat in meetings with 35 people where 10 of them are telling me that Kafka's not performant. And I said, well, I know that there's a telecoms company that are processing 3 million messages a second.
Right.
And they go, really? He's like, well, yeah. Yeah, they do it like this. Oh, right, okay. I said, and there's an ad auction startup that does ad auctions via Kafka through tens of thousands of nodes, and their response times are less than like 8 or 9 milliseconds. So I don't know how you can sit here and tell me it's not performant.
Does it take you a great deal of tweaking and customizing to get to that point, or is there a fairly sensible set of defaults? Like, you were talking about producer side configuration as a knowledge gap for developers that teams can get wrong. What's it look like in the cluster or on the clients to get to that?
There is some tweakage, but it's usually around retention policy. You know, because your default's 7 days, 168 hours. We normally double that to 14 days. It's fine and fair enough. But the actual throughputs, the more tweaking is actually for things like Replicator and Connect, especially Replicator, because obviously you may be working across a wide area network, so your latency times increase. So it's things like that more than anything.
Gotcha. Okay. And that does look a little custom, and it takes someone with some knowledge of the internals and how to monitor things and how to take measurements. It takes a Jace.
Like I said in my talk last night, I'm referring to my talk last night. It will be available on the Confluent community website.
Okay. Yeah, link in the show notes.
I've now completely lost my train of thought because I'm being silly. I'm sorry.
Tweaking of things and
tweaking of things.
Are you?
Oh, it's gone. I'm sorry.
Well, next question.
It'll come back to me.
It'll come back to you, and I'm not done. I have more. I'm a little shaken by you saying that those simple producer settings are a common problem. That's motivating to me, because I don't feel like my team addresses that publicly enough. We sort of have this attitude. Oh yeah, those are those settings. Of course you know those. Let's get on to the meaty stuff, you know. But maybe not really.
No, I kind of see where you're coming from, and I can understand when you're selling a an ecosystem and a platform, that's your way of thinking. But when it goes to the outside world, there may be, let's take a cluster, for example, that might say, okay, we have producers that are taking information in from, could be point of sale, okay? And it's using that producer to send the transaction event to the brokers. Okay, that's the simple part. That's easy. I want KSQL to do this. Okay, that's a KSQL bit. But what we're not talking about is how do we get the POS system to talk to the producer? How's that working? How's that monitored? So there's one team on that side of things. And then on the other side of the spectrum, especially with things like Kafka Connect, and I said this last night in one of my slides, the latency, your biggest problem of latency is the thing that Kafka Connect syncs to, which is either a database or it could be Elasticsearch, or there's something in that connection that can go wrong. And if that connection is slow, then everything else is slow. You can have the fastest broker cluster setup in the world, but if everything's sluggish between the Kafka Connect and, say, an Oracle database or MySQL or Elasticsearch, doesn't matter what, then that's where the actual problem is. You know, it kind of goes out of scope a little bit. But there's all, so there might be a database team involved, there might be a data science team involved who are writing KSQL jobs, but that's their zero focus on just writing those jobs for that function. And then there might be developers that are writing producers and consumers, but not necessarily knowing in the internals of Kafka, like we just touched on. So I don't, and like I said, with the community aspect, we kind of all think that everyone operates in this bubble, that we all know the ecosystem and we all know how Kafka works. And I now maintain that developers don't work like that. They don't necessarily know about the internals, but they know how to create a producer, they know how to create a consumer, or they know how to create a streaming API job, for example, and deploy them.
Now, you gave some examples of some, I'll use the word ignorance, that's in...
I'm ignorant. I like to be the most stupidest person in the room, so I learn more.
Stupid different is different. The ignorance in the non-judgmental sense of I haven't been told yet, but you know, there's ignorance of what happens when you set axe equals to zero. So you talked about that basic producer behavior. What do developers need in your experience? So you're operating the cluster, you're usually taking this, I not look at the messages, but I may not look at the messages, but you're also being this educator, popularizer, evangelist. What do you think are, what's the core set of Kafka knowledge that a developer should have? Jace is doing my 2021 planning for me right here, folks, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, I'm also
directly extracting this knowledge from him, so I know what kind of materials to build. But please, Mr. Bell, go on.
Mr. Bell, oh, it's got formal all of a sudden.
Yes.
It's now contractual. that's a really good question. So from a developer perspective, broad brush overview of what Kafka does. I know that there are tons and tons of videos, blog posts, meetup sessions and those kinds of things that already do a very good job of doing that. But the whole crux for a developer is, and it's usually time constraint. It's like, we're going to adopt Kafka. We need to write a producer. We need to write a consumer. Go. It's kind of like that. So what we do as developers is we go hunting and we go to GitHub and we pull down the Confluent examples or the Apache examples, for example. Yeah. Most of my learning started from the getting started page. You know? Yeah. So, and it wasn't really concerned about partition counts, how replication worked. It was really a case of I have a job to do here. So I need to write this code. So what I've done with our customers is I have a lot of Google documentation with overviews of Kafka, for developers. I mean, it's not written specifically for developers, but I do get asked, oh, could you just put this document together that just sort of says what it is and what it does? And it's like, yeah, okay. And then we'll take that to the next stage where it then becomes kind of internalized in a wiki and then becomes what we're trying to get to is a place of best practice. So, I mean, the thing with the retries is a good example of that. It's like, okay, so I want every, because also with a big organization, you might have 10 different teams working with Kafka that don't necessarily know how Kafka works. And they've all got their own individual use cases. And they may work in different ways. But if you can give them community of practice guidelines that says, okay, this is how we're going to base our producer. It's going to have acts equal all. So we need to know that the message has been written to the leader and all the followers. And you're going to implement the producer interceptor to know and register that the message has been successfully written. Or if there's an issue, then what happens with that message? It's those kinds of things. Do I make sense?
What do you do? What do you think about larger organizations who wrap APIs? Like, so instead of directly using the consumer API, you use the big corp consumer or big corp producer. Is that a thing that you see? Do you love it? Do you hate it?
Fortunately, I don't have to develop in Spring myself, so I'm quite happy with that. But some industries would be quite happy to wrap everything.
Folks, that was shade. I don't know if you caught it, but that was shade.
You'll find a lot of things written in Spring Boot, which is fine. It's years since I've done any proper Java development in Spring, so it's a long time ago now, seven years ago. So they tend to work off frameworks, and it's an interesting overview of how certain developers work within certain organizations. If I went into, well, I actually give you an example. There's a company in Belfast, I won't name who it was, who invited me down years ago now. And the CTO and I are friends. Anyway, I talk at his conferences. I usually cause trouble at his conferences by talking. I do this all on purpose. This is why I get asked to do these things. He said, come down. I'll show you around. I'd like to have a chat with you and see if there's a way that we can get you here. I said, okay. And it's a big organization. You know, it's IPO'd. It's big. And within 10 minutes, we both looked at each other in the room and go, I'd be too much of a maverick here. I wouldn't work. You'd hate me. You'd all hate me. This isn't right. How I do software.
It would end badly.
It would. And we both looked at each other, and he agreed with me. And I said, look, I'd either get bored here, or I would probably drive everyone up the wall, because there are certain things that I would expect code to do that may not necessarily fit with where you're at, you know, those kinds of things. So developer to organization fit is important to start off with. And if certain organizations may not necessarily be looking for a software developer. They might be looking at someone who's absolutely brilliant at Spring, and that is fine. There are people out there who know Spring far better than I do. And they will fit. And they will do a fantastic job, and more power to them. Whereas there are also the sort of maverick, startup-y type developers as well. I mean, it takes all sorts to make the world go round. So it's not a criticism. I'm actually all for it. But they wouldn't fit in a big organization. And those kinds of folk tend to know straight away, I wouldn't fit there. I wouldn't be able to do that. So it's interesting from the point of view when it comes to learning, because it's very much a case of, we need to do this in a big organization, go write it. We're doing it in Spring Boot. This is how you do it. The docs are there, and they go off, they write the code. It goes through QA and all the rest of it, and it's perfect code-wise. But they still don't know how it's really going to behave on a cluster until it's published and deployed on the cluster and they get going with it. Now, like I say, I don't see half of this stuff. all I see are the messages coming through on monitoring statistics. And then I'll get an email that says, we're doing this and we're thinking of doing this. And what do you think of this? And instead of saying, it's not my job, what I say is, okay, let's have a conversation about it. And that's what we end up doing. And that's fine. It's everyone's got a different way of doing things.
They do. They do. And it's good. It's good to take stock of yourself and your way of doing things and a larger, perhaps more staid organization and whether you'll be fit.
I have been really blessed to work with some great SMEs, some great larger companies, and then also have service companies who have large clients. So I've seen a fairly broad range of different people, different use cases, different ways of working. On the opposite side of that, I've also seen different politics, which, you know, happens wherever you are.
It's a thing.
It is a thing. And how people react in meetings and how people get to a point of an agreement and how things are discussed and how do we move forward with this? And it's all interesting. It's part of life's rich tapestry.
Indeed. Another thing that's part of life's rich tapestry, segue coming up here, is you've got a book.
That was pretty neat there, Tim.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad, I could have just like let it be a segue, but I felt like I had to kind of hang a lantern on it. Like, wow, this is such a segue. Let's just call it out. You've got a book, not even on Kafka, but on machine learning. Tell us about it.
I was approached by another author who'd been referred to me by a good friend of mine, Matt Johnson. And basically Matt said, yeah, Jason can string a sentence together. So we started chatting about doing co-authoring a machine learning book. And this chap had already made inroads with Wiley to publish it. And that was fine. And about a month went by of back and forth and the publisher was all on for it. And we needed to do some polishing on the proposal. And then unfortunately, there was something in a contract that said that he was not allowed to work on it.
So the publisher came contract, to me. I assume.
Yeah. These things happen. You know,
it's good. I think good to do to your employees to encourage them not to contribute to the state of the art or teaching other people or creating educational artifacts. I recommend that, employers. Anyway, Jason, sorry, go on. Your co-author, unfortunately.
So unfortunately, my co-author had to pull out of the project. The commissioning editor came back to me and she said, what do you want to do? Do you want to find someone else to help you? And the great thing about being completely blind to writing a book for the first time is you go, yeah, it'll be fine. Can't be that difficult.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Yeah.
It's not. It's really hard. I said, what I'd like to do is actually take the proposal and redo it. Because there's dozens and dozens of books on machine learning that are all theoretical. And the proposal that we had was great. Do not get me wrong. It was a fantastic proposal. But I said, I want to write something a bit more developer-focused. And it's not so much a case of how we learn how these algorithms work. I said, that's been done dozens and dozens of times. The real question is, how do we deploy these things? How do we write code around it? And how does a software developer who wants to learn about machine learning actually start learning about it? So that was back in 2014. And I wrote that over 7 months. And it got published in October 2014.
In only 57 months.
Yes. There was a life event that kind of accelerated things a bit. I had to have an operation on my neck to have a disc removed because it was crushing my spinal cord.
Oh, yes.
So, yes, just one of the obvious ones. So I became very focused on getting as much of the first draft done as I could, not knowing what was going to happen post-op. Because one of the downsides of this operation, if anything happened, was either I was going to die or I was going to be paralyzed from the neck down. Okay. But everything's okay. So everything's fine. Yeah. And I finished the book. The consultant surgeon is a fantastic man. Yeah, so I finished that book in October 2014. And that was all good. That was all very interesting. And it was an interesting time because it was just kind of ahead of the curve for the media explosion of AI and machine learning and all those kinds of things.
Yep.
So it was an interesting time to be involved and to be sort of coding things and understanding how it happened. And 2019, I was asked to do the second edition, which by this point in 2019, an awful lot had happened. You know, self-driving cars and biased algorithms. Yeah, and
I was going to say, 2014 to 2019, huge difference in the machine. So this is the second edition of a book. It's not clear whether it's even the same book at this point, right?
I would say it was... I went back to them and was honest with them. I said, look, there's half a rewrite here.
Yeah. I mean, it's same, I guess, same ISBN, second edition and all that, but, you know, so Theseus, call your office.
Yeah. So the part that you'll be really interested in, Tim, is that I took out the Hadoop chapter and replaced it with a Kafka chapter.
I am not sad about that. I think
I didn't think there would be somehow, you know, so bye-bye, yellow elephant, and hello, K with circles on the end of the logo.
K with made out of circles. Yeah.
So there's a chapter on Kafka in there, and that is pretty much an entire chapter on building a self-learning machine learning platform. So data gets ingested in with Kafka Connect, goes through the system, gets piped out with Kafka Connect to create files, which then can trigger the models. So there's a linear regression model, there's a neural network model, and there's a decision tree model. I'm having to rack my brain. It's been a while since I looked at this now. And then there was an API that I wrote in Clojure, my favorite programming language, to do the predictions via HTTP. So yeah, it was an interesting... That started out as a talk that I did for Strata London in 2018, and then became part of the chapter of the book, because it's a project in itself, really. It's quite a big project. And then the rest of the book, there's a chapter on Spark, there's a chapter on R, and then there's coverage of... There's a Stats 101 chapter now. There's things about data cleaning and data acquisition, which doesn't really get talked about either. And I think it's one of the joys of doing the job that I do is I'm so knee deep in data, cleaning it and all the rest of it, that I don't mind writing about it and talking about it. Whereas there's a lot of people that just think it's not important. And to be honest, it's probably the most important part of the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so which is why that we should all be using Schema Registry and Afro payloads. Anyway, so yes, I wrote a book. So the second edition came out in 2020 in February, and then COVID happened. So I've still got the author copies at my feet under my desk.
Yeah, right.
Because I haven't been to any conference to give them out.
Yeah. So what's a thing you're most excited about coming up in the near future of Kafka? A thing you'd like to see happen? Give us an aspiration for the future.
Right. Well, first of all, it's great to see tiered storage. That's really interesting. I've not looked at it properly yet because I just have not had the time to look at it. Obviously, I've been dancing in circles in the street about KIP 500 because it means that I no longer have to even think about RabbitMQ as much as I love RabbitMQ.
You don't have to feel the allure of a zookeeperless system that's kind of like Kafka in some way.
The one thing that I would miss about RabbitMQ is RPC like client connections. Oh. Anyway,
okay.
The one thing that Kafka, if you were to do it in Kafka, you'd have an input topic and an output topic. Which actually is quite interesting if you take things into consideration, like the rendezvous model, which Ted Dunning has talked about quite a bit in times gone by, where you can have multiple machine learning models. So you send out a single request via a topic, for example, and then 10 answers come back, and the rendezvous model collates the answers and then forwards them on to, say, an output prediction topic, those kinds of things. But as I say, the RPC thing, it was just something that was really cool in Rabbit that I always liked, because it was just simple to do. And it meant you weren't required to write separate consumer and producer for it. You could just write it in a single producer, wait for the response, and there you were. Anyway.
Right. When you've got a synchronous operation that you're kind of bridging to in the outside world.
Yeah, exactly. So, Kip 500 is interesting. Would I be adopting it straight away? I don't know. Because that isn't my call in terms of work clients. There'll be lots of discussions about it. So my gut feeling is it's probably going to be the back end of 2021, start of 2022, when people have tested it. We've seen some community feedback. There might have been a patch or two by that time, you know, those kinds of things. I think it's just a case of being sensible about it, but I am excited about it. I'm really, really excited about it. It's interesting to watch. I'm excited to see what else the community will come up with, actually. There's some interesting talks that have been kicking about. Once again, time is never on my side, so I don't actually... I probably sound like one of these Kafka folk that I'm absolutely involved in everything. I actually think that David Klein's omnipresent.
It turns out he's not, but that is illusion. He's not. Well, yeah.
First of all, thank you for confirming that for me.
I can confirm, but
because he seems to operate on all time zones. That's what I don't understand.
The thing, nobody understands how, but he does.
Has he got a Hootsuite account? Is that what he's doing? I just realized.
Time Turner. I'm trying to remember from Harry Potter. Maybe I don't. Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, the virtual being forced not to do in-person conferences, which I kind of miss, has opened up this explosion of some fantastic content and meetups virtually. And it was so cool last night that, I mean, so listeners, it's all very well talking at the Cleveland, Ohio Kafka meetup, but when you're in the UK, I'm basically talking at 11 o'clock at night and I'm half asleep.
I was wondering.
I was really tired last night. Yeah. It was a long day.
Well, I wasn't at the meetup, not because your performance was tired, but that's a little bit of a time zone.
Yeah. Now, the reason that I did Cleveland to start off with was so I could do the Spinal Tap joke. Hello, Cleveland.
Yes.
Perfect. And I was so happy the first time I did that. I've actually opened other talks in other countries with that, and there's three people in the crowd that usually get it. And it's so good watching their faces because they usually fall off the chair at that point. It's really funny.
That's extremely rewarding.
It's the best. Trust me, it's wonderful. Because This Goes to 11 is kind of used, you know.
It is, and nobody even really knows it's a Spinal Tap thing. It's just kind of in the lexicon, and Hello Cleveland is a lot more.
When I took up the bass guitar in 1986, a guy I worked with in a guitar shop lent me his copy of Spinal Tap on video, and he says, if you're going to be in a band, you'll need to watch this. And it was the best thing he ever did.
Yes.
And he's still a dear friend now. I don't take these things too seriously, as you gathered. The reason I did Cleveland is because Dave Klein, Anna McDonald, Shay all encouraged me to do so. And I said, yeah, okay. It's going to be late. That's fine. Not a problem. I actually quite enjoy doing it. And it's interesting to get a different audience. I think this, if there is one thing that I would encourage people to do, especially if they're doing talks on Kafka or development on Kafka for that fact, is to do talks that are not in their natural time zone, because you get a different kind of audience. Some of them got some very different questions. Yeah, it's really interesting. Notice
I've found that in my speaking career very true. Even different regions of the United States, definitely different regions of the world. There are different default interests, yeah, and kinds of questions, and the nature of question asking varies from place to place. Sometimes it's stump the chump. Sometimes it's super deferential and embarrassed to be asking. Sometimes it's, why the heck haven't you answered this already? It just depends. And it's great to get that.
And one of the things I've always tried to put across in talks is there's no such thing as a stupid question. I think every question's valid. And every question that someone asks deserves an answer. And it's like, yeah, I would hate to say to someone, oh, you should know that. That's just very arrogant to do that kind of thing. I would never do that. And if I have in any point in my 32-year career, I do apologize. I always pitch my talks to someone who is coming into this new and doesn't know. And if people know their stuff, they usually don't mind hearing it again, because they might actually learn something new. And it's an interesting concept I found, is I'm willing to listen to someone who's used Kafka for 6 years, 7 years. But you know what? I'm also willing to listen to someone who's used Kafka for 6 months, because they tend to uncover things that you'd not even considered or thought about. Or they might have found something out that you just didn't know about. And I would have learned that. That's really interesting. I want to know about that. Please tell me about it. You know, so I found talks have been really interesting as well, especially virtually, is you as a speaker can come away with new information that you'd never even considered before, as much as the information that you're imparting to the audience. And that's one of the great things I've realized with the Kafka meetups this year that have happened virtually. There's a real big amount of push and pull, and it's absolutely great. And the conversations afterwards, I mean, I did not hang about too long last night. I was really tired. Was the conversations afterwards as well. And we were talking about deleting topics with thousands of partitions. It takes so long. It blocks things. How do we solve that? Is there anything we can do about it? Those kinds of things. I was talking this afternoon with my CTO, Johnny Miller, and he learnt KSQL does not have a DLQ for failed messages on converts. And it's just like, I'd really like that. You know, I think that's actually quite important, because that's the way I think.
You don't learn that kind of thing without that kind of interaction, right?
Absolutely. And I can't keep an eye on Slack channels 24 hours a day. And I'm not even going to attempt to, in all fairness. I subscribe to about 6 or 7 different Slack channels, Clojure ones, the Confluent community one, which is great, where Dave Klein bends my ear about doing another talk, which is really nice. It's nice to be wanted. There's so much content at the minute, I can't keep it all in. You know, I can't find the time to sit down and listen to it all either. So I'm probably going to spend Christmas. I actually said to Shay last night, because do you want to do another meetup tour? And I said, January, I'm not doing anything else in 2020. So Tim, you're the last talk that I'm doing this year.
And with that, my guest today has been Jason Bell. Jace, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST, that's 60PDCAST, to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway,
As always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.